My name is Chris Sharon. I teach at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. And I'm here for 2 weeks at Holden, just finishing the board meeting today. And I taught a little bit last week before the board meeting, and I'll be teaching 3 sessions this week. And I want to start, first of all, just framing how I'm going about this conversation about Christianity and torture, especially looking at the last 10 years in the United States. Today, I want to start by, and each session will have a similar format, I want to start with some provocation, some experiential exercise that gets us talking about our experience of what we've almost all of us, I'm sure, lived through. And then the middle part of the session, I'll do some background information that will help us in going deeper into the experiences we all have had individually to think about what's happened today in the United States over the last 10 years. On Thursday, looking at the 1930s, 20s and 30s in Germany and the 1970s in Chile as among many case studies that could be looked at, case studies that help shed some light on our circumstances. And then the last day, asking about particular understandings of the church and its relationship to society that can either prohibit or occlude the church's sense, its vision of its own political responsibility, or encourage it, foster it. So, and then, so that middle section, we'll have some background work, and then we'll end by looking at a spiritual practice that is an ordinary Christian practice, something that most congregations, if not all congregations, do, and ask the question, is there a way that done with a kind of moral seriousness about our time might foster in us the capacity to be the kind of active citizens of the kingdom of God, of the reign of God, in a nation in which we're also citizens. So at root, this is a conversation about two kinds of citizenship. Citizenship that is in heaven or in the reign of God or embodied in the community of Christ gathered around the table and worship, and the citizenship we have in a nation. So that's the overall frame. I want to begin, first of all, just by reading a parable that sets the stage for the whole series. It's from a new book by Peter Rawlins called The Orthodox Heretic. And the parable is called No Conviction. In a world where following Christ is decreed to be a subversive and illegal activity, you have been accused of being a believer, arrested, and dragged before a court. You have been under clandestine surveillance for some time now, and so the prosecution has been able to build up quite a case against you. They begin the trial by offering the judge dozens of photographs that show you attending church meetings, speaking at religious events, and participating in various prayer and worship services. After this, they present a selection of items that have been confiscated from your home, religious books that you own, worship CDs, and other Christian artifacts. Then they step up the pace by displaying many of the poems, pieces of prose, and journal entries you have lovingly written concerning your faith. Finally, in closing, the prosecution offers your Bible to the judge. It is well worn, with scribbles and notes, drawings and underlines throughout, evidence, as if it were needed, that you had read and reread this sacred text many times. Throughout the case, you have been sitting silently in fear and trembling. You know deep in your heart that with the large body of evidence that has been amassed by the prosecution, you face the possibility of a long imprisonment or even execution. At various times throughout the proceedings, you have lost all confidence and have been on the verge of standing up and denying Christ. But while this thought has plagued your mind throughout the trial, you resist the temptation and remain focused. Once the prosecution has finished presenting their case, the judge proceeds to ask if you have anything to add, but you remain silent and resolute, terrified that if you open your mouth, even for a moment, you might deny the charges made against you. Like Christ, you remain silent before your accusers. In response, you are led outside to wait as the judge ponders your case. The hours pass slowly as you sit under guard in the foyer, waiting to be summoned back. Eventually, a young man in uniform appears and leads you into the courtroom so that you may hear the verdict and receive word of your punishment. Once you have been seated at the dock, the judge, a harsh and unyielding man, enters the room, stands before you, looks deep into your eyes, and begins to speak. Of the charges that have been brought forward, I find the accused not guilty. Not guilty? Your heart freezes. Then in a split second, the fear and terror that have moments before threatened to strip your resolve are swallowed up by confusion and rage. Despite the surroundings, you stand defiantly before the judge and demand that he give an account concerning why you are innocent of the charges in light of the evidence. What evidence? He replies in shock. What about the poems and prose that I wrote? You reply. They simply show you think of yourself as a poet, nothing more. But what of the services I spoke at, the times I wept in church, and the long sleepless nights of prayer? Evidence that you are a good speaker and actor, nothing more, replied the judge. It is obvious you deluded those around you, and perhaps at times even deluded yourself, but this foolishness is not enough to convict you in a court of law. But this is madness, you shout. It would seem that no evidence would convince you. Not so, replies the judge, as if informing you of a great, long-forgotten secret. The court is indifferent toward your Bible reading and church attendance. It has no concern for worship with words and a pen. It continue to develop your theology and use it to paint pictures of love. We have no interest in such armchair artists who spend their time creating images of a better world. We exist only for those who would lay down that brush and their life in a Christ-like endeavor to make a better world. So until you live as Christ and his followers did, until you challenge this system and become a thorn in our side, until you die to yourself and offer your body to the flames, until then, my friend, you are no enemy of ours. I start with that parable because it convicts me. And a part of the reason I started to teach in this area has nothing to do with my expertise. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a political scientist. I don't have the time to read deeply enough and understand all the complexity in these all sorts of components to the events that have taken place over the last 10 years, since September 11th, and before that even. I've engaged it partly because I just feel convicted that it needs to be spoken of, that we need to examine ourselves, and I need to examine myself. And one of the linchpins for me was this spring when this survey from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life came out, saying that, in fact, in their survey of Americans, church going was a direct correlation to support for torture. So lots of people in this room are going to have all sorts of knowledge that will contribute to our conversation, and I hope for that. And I've tried to structure a conversation that both leads us into some of the heart of what transpired and also gives space for us to talk with one another and ends up at a place where we all are able to do something. And today we'll end up at the font. So to start out with, I want to show two clips of Manhattan on September 11th, just to take us back to that moment, and then just one-to-one, not in groups, but just one-to-one, share with someone next to you where you were, what you felt. Just without going back there, despite the difficulty, the heart wrench of it, it's hard to get back to the place where our country was and where these events that we're trying to get at in large part began.
It was 8:46 in the morning. And then we heard a plane come over, and in Manhattan, you don't hear planes too often, other than special loud ones.
So now just one-to-one, take a minute and just share with one another where you were, how you reacted that day, that moment. For many people around the world, it was a devastating day on a lot of levels. I lived in Connecticut, and back close to New York City, one of the questions we were all asking is, who do you know, and have you heard from them, and this kind of intimacy of proximity to Manhattan. But it didn't really matter where people were, a sense of all kinds of emotion. So I think one place that we as a sort of community of nations who shared in the loss of that day started was in shock and in mourning. And it wasn't a new event, and I'll get to this when I do a little bit more of the timeline. In one sense, it was 93, right, that the first attempt to blow up the Twin Towers took place. So there had been previous experiences of this, but this was so shockingly successful. Not only this, but obviously the Pentagon and the Shanksville, Pennsylvania plane that didn't end up making it to its target. But fairly quickly, our leadership emerged from the immediate crisis of that day and the following day very resolute that we would have a devastating response, really. And very quickly, Donald Rumsfeld realized that the power now was in the White House. And I picked this picture on purpose, really, because it evokes for me the way in which he recognized what this moment offered, what it meant in terms of executive power. And the language very quickly, if you read transcripts of speeches from the week after September 11th, turned to this kind of hunting language. And whatever we might make of that, and we can talk about that later, it's just the fact that that's the language. Even President Obama, in a number of speeches, has adopted that same language of hunting down the terrorists, wherever they are. President Bush said, we'll go to their holes and we'll pull them out. So very quickly, the rhetoric went in a direction I think that we'll see patterns of as we look at other case studies of circumstances of the kind of thing that happened here. One of the directions that they went, and I'll get to it in more detail in the background section in just a minute, is to introduce through a series of steps the possibility of what they called harsh interrogation tactics, and many people call torture. And there have been surveys by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life going back to 2003-2004, when indications began to come out publicly that these tactics were being used. And the public view of the acceptability of torture has not changed very much over those years, from 2003-2004 to 2009. But this Pew survey was the first that really tried to gauge the difference, such as it is, that religious faith or religious participation might make. And it's pretty surprising. You can see the total U.S. population. If you can't read the distinctions, the far left is torture against suspected terrorists can often be justified. So 15% of the U.S. public says it can often be justified. 34% sometimes. So a pretty big chunk says it can be justified. 22% rarely, and 25% never, with only a 4% don't know, refused slot. And then they look at the relationship between white evangelical Protestants, who tend to lean Republican and more conservative, to white mainline Protestants, who tend to lean Democratic and liberal. And there's a significant difference both in the number overall who say torture would be justified, and the largest of any of the samples that say torture is never justified is in that white mainline Protestant group. But I'm reluctant to jump to a position of patting ourselves on the back, those of us who belong to those churches, because the stripe down here of percentages who would often or sometimes justified is so large in every case, and I find that so disturbing. But you see, the unaffiliated here has the lowest percentage who often or sometimes would approve torture. Then down here, it's religious attendance. Weekly religious attendance is the predictor of support for torture. Those who seldom or never attend are both least likely to say it's acceptable and most likely to say it's never acceptable. A friend of mine who works in Washington doing religious polling did a survey of this white Southern, he's a Southern Baptist, grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, and his specialty is religion and public life, but especially the Southern white evangelical bloc. And he did a survey with them to ask what they based their view about torture on, and initially a majority of those respondents said life experience, 60-some percent said life experience and common sense, and only in the 30s, 35% or so said that their Christian faith was what they used in making that decision. But when prompted and said, if the tactics we use were used against our soldiers, would you support using those tactics? You can see that it changes. This is called the golden rule question. And if they use the golden rule question, it changes dramatically. 52% say rarely or never versus 31% saying rarely or never. And when we get to this in a minute, I'll have something more to say about that golden rule question. But just now, take, again, a couple of minutes with the person or two next to you and talk about what you see here and your response to it and what it makes you think. And we'll have a chance to come back with a couple of comments to the whole group. But talk together for just a minute about how you react to this kind of data. For the sake of balancing the interest in hearing a little bit of what one another said and the interest in moving ahead, let's just take a couple of reactions from different parts of the room just to sample what people were thinking. What? How about over here? Someone want to share what they were thinking briefly?
What's torture? You didn't know what was defined as torture.
Okay. We'll get to that. Any other? I mean, you can guess that it's bad. You know what I mean? So if it raises the question, if someone uses that word, would you think that Christians would be in favor of it? What did you talk about beside sort of along those lines? Did you go past that question of what torture is?
Never got past it.
Okay. Yeah.
We just talked a little bit about the fact that we live in a country where Christian people basically feel that politically we're favored by God. Mm-hmm. And if you attack us, you're attacking God, and so it's okay.
So, yeah. Did people hear that?
Yeah.
In America, we think God is ours. God is on our side. So when people attack us, they're attacking our God, our way of life, our understanding of faith. Let's stop over here and come to the middle section. Yeah.
As a Catholic, the people who have voted there are very much against abortion, which is torture. And yet here, when it comes to torture of terrorists, 32% said sometimes. You know, it's a contradiction, in my opinion.
Yeah, half are in favor at some level. Over here, somebody from over here.
We were thinking we shouldn't go to church every week anymore.
Somebody, yeah, Amy. We got somebody up on top. Amy.
We were just talking about how shocking it was, especially given that Jesus was killed on a Roman torture device.
Yeah. You know, one of the ways I sort of track what people who aren't Christian think about Christians is I read comments on stories in the New York Times, because most of the people who read the New York Times aren't Christian or are very liberal. And the news story on this, over and over again, people say, well, no wonder people who go to church support torture because they worship this torture device and wear it around their neck all the time. So this perception from the outside is that we have some kind of fixation with torture. So there's a pretty big misperception or confusion about that. Yeah.
We were talking about why it's only white people. There are plenty of black religious people that might follow.
Yeah, here's the problem with sampling. This is such a small sample that you don't get enough of either religious or ethnic minorities to have a justifiable number. So the N was just too small with this sample. It was only 742 people. So they actually did get people who were from minorities, both different minority religions in the U.S. and ethnic cultural minorities, but they don't report it because of the small numbers.
Doesn't small numbers sometimes skew data?
It's always skewed. That's the problem. You know, this is what it is, and it tells some of the truth about what's going on in the U.S., but there are lots of problems with it, and that's one of them. The difficulty is partly cost, because doing a survey that's big enough to capture that is actually much, much more expensive, so it's a big challenge.
You know what the level of significance was on this study?
No. I didn't look that closely at it. I have it, though, here, if you want to look at it. Let's just go back and do a little background together with how we got to a circumstance where we're internationally accused of practicing torture against the detainees captured in Afghanistan and Iraq. As I said earlier, you could take the timeline back farther, but I just started with the 90s and a couple of both domestic and international attacks, as far as is known, that were planned by Al-Qaeda and leading up to the dramatic September 11th attacks. And it was just a week or two after the September 11th attacks that legal opinion was written. It was in fact written by John Wu, who was at that time still teaching at UC Berkeley in constitutional law and hadn't yet come to work in Washington, basically making the case that George Bush could claim all necessary and appropriate force in fighting those behind 9/11 wherever they were preemptively. So that argument, although it didn't come out in a policy statement until I think 2002 when the national security big statement came out, it was in his language right away. And it's less than a month, October 7th, when the war in Afghanistan begins. Here's Dick Cheney's comment right afterwards, September 16th, 2001. We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. It's going to be vital for us to use any means at our disposal, basically, to achieve our objective.
When was the Patriot Act passed?
I don't know for sure. Somewhat later. I would think more than a year later, but I don't know for sure.
Shorter.
So, just taking them, he said it on Meet the Press, it was on TV. You know, there's evidence even now, now that we can look back at and see, even then there was some indication that we might have worried about where things would go. Where did they go? January 11th, 2002, the first 20 people were sent to the prison at Guantanamo Bay. They wanted to come up with a place where they could hold the prisoners captured in Afghanistan that, first of all, would be very remote, not threatened by attack by anyone, and Guantanamo Bay is very remote. And they wanted it in an area where the prisoners, in a sense, would be totally isolated. And it was chosen, and they took the prisoners there, and they built, the very first picture I had up was Camp X-Ray, which they built and used for about 1 year. Donald Rumsfeld, in a press conference, said, in response to charges that they were being mistreated, you know, these prisoners have gone from hot desert Afghanistan to a prison facility in sunny, pleasant Cuba. You know, of course they're fine. But in fact, they were like kennels. They were simply concrete with barbed wire and metal fencing. And the prisoners were very often hooded with earmuffs over their ears. So they just had no idea where they were. And one of those 20 prisoners was Mohammed El-Qahtani, referred to as detainee 63. I guess I'll get to him in a minute. But he had flown into Orlando from Dubai in August of 2001 and had a one-way ticket and $2,000 cash on him. And the immigration officers didn't buy his story, and so they sent him back to Dubai. And he was supposed to be one of the hijackers, although he says that to this day, he says he didn't know what the mission was. He had been in Afghanistan and had been recruited for a martyr mission, but he didn't know what it was. And so he was one of the people who was captured in Afghanistan, and they recognized after a time who he was because they fingerprinted the prisoners and matched his fingerprint to this person who had tried to enter the United States at the end of August. So that's January. Also in January, there was this debate emerging between the State Department and the Department of Justice about the applicability of the Geneva Conventions and the prisoner of the category of prisoner of war. And this is where one place where that golden rule idea comes back into play. And I just want to briefly summarize what Colin Powell's counsel to the president is. They had drafted a memorandum, John Wu actually, the same young professor of law who clerked with Clarence Thomas at the Supreme Court and was a member, if you're a lawyer or know the law, he was a member of the Federalist Society, and so he had all the conservative credentials you could want. And he wrote this opinion along with some others saying that Geneva shouldn't apply because of the terrorists being non-state actors and not dressed as combatants. And so in the typical understanding of war when Geneva was written, they said these fighters wouldn't apply. So Colin Powell writes this response, and he says basically, the memo is totally misleading and doesn't explain to the president the pros and cons of applying Geneva or not. And so he advises that they list the pros and cons involved. And here's what he says. The cons of saying Geneva Convention does not apply. And do people generally, I'm not going to go into all the detail, but do people generally know what the Geneva Conventions are? Lots of nodding. It's basic protection and humane treatment, and it allows prisoners to be able to answer simple questions, name, rank, serial number, and so forth. So they govern, they're signed by many nations and govern basic protections for prisoners captured in conflict. He says, if we don't follow Geneva, it will reverse over a century of U.S. policy and practice. It will have a high cost in terms of negative international reaction. It will undermine public support among critical allies. Europeans and others will likely have legal problems with extradition. It will provoke some individual foreign prosecutors to investigate and prosecute our officials and troops, so we'll be charged with war crimes. It will make us more vulnerable to domestic and international legal challenge. It undermines the president's military order by removing an important legal basis for trying detainees. In other words, evidence gotten from investigations won't be usable in a court of law, and will be challenged in the international fora, UN Commission on Human Rights, World Court, etc. So then he gives reasons why it would be helpful to have Geneva apply, and he makes the strong argument that the memo as it was presented includes misleading factual errors in order to try and convince the president that not following Geneva is both legitimate and advantageous. And clearly, Colin Powell lost to the memo that through John Yoo and others came to Alberto Gonzalez and then to President Bush, because on February 7th, President Bush issued this executive order. Subject, humane treatment of al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees. By its terms, Geneva applies to conflicts involving high contracting parties, which can only be states. Moreover, it assumes the existence of regular armed forces fighting on behalf of states. He talks about a new paradigm and says this new paradigm has been ushered in not by us, but by the terrorists, and it requires new thinking in the law of war. This is the language, the position that John Yoo developed, that this is a new era and it requires a new paradigm. And so he basically just says the provisions of Geneva do not apply. I have the authority under the Constitution to suspend Geneva, and then he says, Geneva will apply to our present conflict with the Taliban, but Taliban detainees will not be protected under Common Article 3 because it only refers to armed conflict, not of an international character. So on a technicality, he says we won't actually protect the detainees according to Geneva, even though we're going to say it technically applies to the conflict. Then he concludes, ironically, our values as a nation call for us to treat detainees humanely. As a matter of policy, the United States Armed Forces shall continue to treat detainees humanely and to the extent appropriate and consistent with military necessity in a manner consistent with the principles of Geneva. So, a second major figure in Al-Qaeda, Abu Zubaydah, was captured in Pakistan in March. And with these two, and there were others who were considered, quote, high-value detainees, pressure began to build from the highest places, especially Donald Rumsfeld, but others, to get actionable intelligence about what the plans were. And one of the reasons I started with September 11th is because the atmosphere of paranoia and fear was so palpable. People wondered, where's the next strike going to be? You have the whole alert system of orange and yellow and whatever, I don't even know what it is anymore. But at the time, they had this sense that the next strike was imminent, and they wanted to know, where is it going to be? Department of Defense and CIA officials explored a particular approach to stronger tactics instead of the typical tactics of building rapport over time and beginning to hear the story the person has to tell. They got this from the SERE program. I don't know how they pronounce it, but it stands for Survival Evasion Resistance Escape Program that was built by the Air Force. And the idea of the program was to train people in the U.S. Services to be able to survive if they were to be captured by countries that torture. So they have, as a part of the training program, a set of harsh interrogation methods which they imitate for the sake of training our soldiers to be able to anticipate and hopefully sustain if they were captured. And they hired a couple of psychiatrists to reverse engineer the program and take those interrogation techniques and train our CIA investigators in how to use those as an offensive program to gather information from the terrorist detainees. And this program and the work that was done to reverse engineer it was based on the work of American psychologist Martin Seligman, who is known for experiments in learned helplessness, randomly shocking caged dogs until they just gave up their will to resist, having no idea what was coming next. So Condoleezza Rice and others inquired about the possibility of gaining the advantage of this set of trainers that we already had who knew these techniques and were training U.S. soldiers to resist them and just use those to train CIA investigators and then have at the hand a series of techniques. So in August that year, a number of memos were written in the White House Legal Counsel Office about these techniques. And here's the gist of what they came up with. Physical pain amounting to torture must be equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injury such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. This was in a U memo to Alberto Gonzalez. In other words, they took the Geneva Conventions away, which had their own definition of torture, which was a much higher bar, and then created their own, based on their reading of U.S. law, their own bar for what torture is at a much, much lower level. Here's a couple of the things that transpired in that set of months. A couple of Office of Legal Counsel lawyers wrote the memos defending these harsh interrogation tactics. And the FBI at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere really believed that what they ought to do is the military interrogation techniques that required rapport and humane treatment and so forth. And they eventually pulled out. They refused to participate in this new CIA initiative. President Bush gave a speech citing a connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda that came from these interrogations, and in the end was obviously false. And Colin Powell's famous speech at the UN also was based on information gained from these harsh interrogations, which also ended up being false. This is the memo from Donald Rumsfeld in December signing off on these new interrogation methods, one of which was requiring people to stand for up to 4 hours at a time as a stress activity. And he works at a standing desk. So he writes in a memo at the bottom, however, I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why is standing limited to 4 hours? Here are the 10 new interrogation tactics. Number one, attention grasp, where you just grab their head on either side of their face and pull them right into your face. So you're both jerking their head to get their attention and going face to face with them. And when that's combined with sleep deprivation, you can see why they might use it to wake someone up to get their attention. Walling, which is building a wall that acts like a drum and then putting them standing with their back to it and slamming them up against it, blindfolded so they don't know what's happening. And the sound of the false wall makes it sound like they're, I'm sure they actually were being slammed hard, but makes it sound worse. Facial hold is just what it sounds like. It's just grabbing their face. Facial slap is what it sounds like, slapping their face. It's unbelievable to actually read the long paragraph-length descriptions of how to do a facial slap, which is here in this Bybee memo. Cramped confinement is putting people in a very, very small, dark space for extended periods of time. Wall standing is putting someone's feet apart and making them lean up against the wall like this and not allowing them to move for long periods of time to try and exhaust them. Stress positions include sitting flat on the ground like this with your arms up in the air for long periods of time, or being shackled to the ground and not being able to move. Sleep deprivation, 4 hours a day they would allow sleep, and the rest of the 20-hour interrogation days, day after day after day, is what they would do. Insects, apparently Al-Qahtani was afraid of insects, and so one of the ideas was to put him in a small box and tell him they were putting a stinging insect in the box with him. And the idea was to put in a caterpillar or something that wasn't harmful, but to tell them that it was a stinging insect. They did this with dogs, too. If they had whatever their phobia was, in other words, this was an idea to take advantage of their phobias. And if they were scared of dogs, they would have dogs with the muzzle on, but if they didn't answer the question, have the dog attack them, and they were blindfolded so they couldn't tell what was happening and thought the dog was loose. And then the waterboard, you've probably heard about it in the news, but the idea is to simulate drowning by putting someone slightly at a level where their feet are elevated and cover their face with a cloth and pour water over it so they suffocate. And the technical idea is that because no water is entering your lungs, you're not actually going to die, but physiologically, you feel like you're dying because you're suffocating. You can't breathe and CO2 builds up, and so it creates panic very quickly. This is detainee number 063 at Guantanamo Bay, who was the first at Guantanamo Bay to have all these tactics applied to him. He was the one who flew in August to Orlando to participate. And I won't read much, but I'll just read, in this book, Torture Team, which is in the bookstore, he ends every chapter with a short section from the log that the interrogators kept. And I'll just read one, just to give you a feeling for it. Just day 28, September 20, 2002. Told detainee, a dog is held in higher esteem because dogs know right from wrong and know to protect innocent people from bad people. Began teaching the detainee lessons such as stay, come, and bark to elevate his social status up to that of a dog. Detainee became very agitated. 1300 hours. Dog tricks continued, and detainee stated he should be treated like a man. Detainee was told he would have to learn who to defend and who to attack. Interrogator showed photos of 9/11 victims and told detainee he should bark happy for these people. Interrogator also showed photos of Al-Qaeda terrorists and told detainee he should growl at these people. A towel was placed on the detainee's head like a burqa with his face exposed, and the interrogator proceeded to give the detainee dance lessons. 2200 hours, the detainee was strip searched. Initially, he was attempting to resist the guards. After approximately five minutes of nudity, the detainee ceased to resist. He stated he did not like the females viewing his naked body while being searched, and if felt that he could have something done about it, he would have. Their standard procedure was always to have women in the room because of the possibility for them, especially translators, because they could violate their space and lots of other things to cross the religious boundary around men and women being together. He was eventually charged last year in 2008, and the charges were dismissed because the evidence was unable to be used in a court of law. And he was held after that, and they're trying to charge him again. But it's unclear whether he'll ever be charged for anything because the confessions and intelligence that they gained from from their conversations with him were under these conditions, and so they're not applicable for a court case.
What kind of mental state is he in now?
Well, I don't know that much about it, but there's interviews with him now, and you can read, there's a new, if people want to see it, there's an article in the New Yorker right now about whether Leon Panetta can take on the CIA and actually do something. And it seems to me like he speaks pretty clearly in English about his circumstance and what happened to him, and has denied the things that he said under torture. What I want to do, partly because we just have a few minutes left, and there's no way really to take stock of this in a way that would satisfy our need to talk about it. It's partly why we want to have multiple sessions. But what I wanted to do as a way to let us all respond each time is to pick a spiritual practice and talk about how spiritual practices can be a way for us to actually take our engagement with these kinds of realities in our public life and speak about them as Christians. And in doing so, deepen our own capacity to be the kinds of people who embody a different reality. And what I wanted to do tonight is to take the baptismal practice of saying yes and no. When people come to baptism, the first thing that they're asked to do is to renounce before they affirm. And this goes back all the way to the very early church. When we baptize, here's what we do. We say, do you renounce the devil and all the forces that defy God? And then we say, I renounce them. Do you renounce? This is in the new red hymnal. In the green LBW, it was just one question about renouncing the devil and We've separated it out to match the three articles of the creed that we say as a positive affirmation. Do you renounce the powers of this world that rebel against God? I renounce them. Do you renounce the ways of sin that draw you away from God? I renounce them. And I just wanted, as a closing practice, for us to take the opportunity to come by the whiteboard, and if you feel there's something you want to renounce, to just write it on the board and then dip your hand in the font as a remembrance of your baptism and our call not only to be affirmers of life in Christ, but renouncers of the brokenness and sin and evil that we see in the world. It's a way for us to conclude that's not discussion-based, but that allows us all to respond. And so if you're upstairs on your way out, just come on in and write something on the board. I hope discussion can happen in all the ways it does at Holden, in and out of coffee hour and meals and evening conversations. And we'll continue, if you're able to come back for other sessions, to talk more about these things. But let's end just with silence and allowing people to come on their way out. Yeah?
Could you mention when the next session is?
It's Thursday at 4, Thursday afternoon. So don't applaud or chat or anything. Just try and respect the space in silence and let people, if you wish, you don't have to, but if you wish to come and write something you might renounce as a part of our baptismal life, and then remember your baptism by dipping your hand in the water.